So it is Thursday, it is December 11th. This is Jen Yeager speaking with Dr. Larry Reynolds in the Seldovia Museum, and this is an interview for the Seldovia Project Jukebox Oral History Project.
December 11th, 2014.
Yes, good addition. So can you just kind of start off telling us a little bit about when you first came to Seldovia and what the town was like, what your first impressions were, and what it was like living here then?
Well, Cheryl and I came here in 1974, drove to Homer, so you go by the bluff and you see the bay. But really, I had come up here with the idea of coming to Seldovia because I had a friend who had spent some time here who was a glaciologist up at University of Fairbanks. And he said, boy, Seldovia would be a really neat place to live if you could pull it off. So I came to Homer, and Dr. Annabeau was the only doctor there then. And he had told many other physicians, including myself, no, I kind of want to do it all by myself for a while. Now, a physician doesn't have a right to say that, but I didn't want to be there anyway. But the hospital was over there those days, opposed to earlier where it was here. That switch kind of took place in the 50s, I take it. But they didn't build a Homer Hospital until the 70s, or maybe it was the late 60s. It was right in that area. At any rate, so we came over here, and there's the old hospital building, which is now Willard's house. So we went in there, and the place was devastated. It was, the roof was leaking, the basement had been leaking through the foundation. And yet here were the hospital guild ladies putting pots and pans in the kitchen. It just happened to be there when Cheryl and I walked in. And that was a great crew. That was Gladys Elsass, Elaine Giles, and who was the other one there? It was at there that day. I'll remember in a minute. There was three of them there. Oh, who are you? What are you doing in here? I had my ponytail then too. Yeah, and I told them, okay, I'm a physician. I'm thinking about moving here. Oh, so they were all for that. At any rate, it went on from there. Seldovia was just about what it is now, except less buildings. I mean, it had rebuilt the flat. The urban renewal had been through. There was a couple of houses out on the flat that looked like Lower 48 houses. Not too much that looked old, except the church on the hill and the... no city building it then, so they had the one down by the ferry, and that warehouse was kind of the thing they used in the city office building that we use now. In the place of what is now our city building, there was a city building, which was an old building that had been a grocery store on the boardwalk, old aluminum-sided building that they dragged up on the flats and planted there.
Where the multi-purpose building is now?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they told me, yeah, we can get you a place to stay here. Just bring your stuff and we'll decondemn it for you. That was okay with me, as long as they paid for the heat, which was really great because it took a lot of heat. The heat of building had no insulation at all. In fact, I can remember one winter day when we came home from some school affair, and we were on the upstairs, and so it was up a stairway on the west side of the building, and then a long hallway down to the one room that had heat in it now. All the pipes in the place were broken except the ones they redid them to come to the place where we lived. But we came in the room in the dark, turned on the switch, which is on an interior wall, Okay, and here's snow coming out to switch.
Oh my.
Had a big cone of snow on the floor. I mean, it was 10, 12 feet from the wall, outside wall. I don't know how it got in there. I imagine the heating bill was quite high. But so we lived above the jail. The jail was right below us. And the city cop, Gary Gunkel, lived below the hospital, which really wasn't a hospital then because we changed it to a clinic. When we first came here in 74, I looked up, what's her name? The physician that was here before us. I'm blocking on her name right now. But she was up in Anchorage, and we went up to see her. Mildred McMurtry. We went to see her, and she says, "Whatever you do, don't live in the hospital." So we lived in above the jail, and the cop lived below the hospital. It was a noisy place to live, above the jail.
Was the jail pretty busy?
Well, you'd have to know Officer Gunkel. He had a way of riling the prisoners up, and he had a fair number of them. Yes. At any rate, so we worked in the clinic, and it was one of those buildings also that required a lot of heat and maintenance. I can remember one time, I can't remember what it was that made me go look down there. There was a power outage or something, and so I went down to look at the wiring in the heater room. Yeah, I had never been down there before. Probably been working in the building for over a year. But went down there, and the electricity was on these porcelain posts, you know, bare wires hanging out from the wall on porcelain posts. And something had blown out. And so we had to get one of the city maintenance guys to come over, and he was kind of hard of hearing. And there were so many different fuse boxes. He was going to work on something that had to do with the heater. And he thought he had turned off the heater, but I could hear it was still buzzing, and he couldn't hear it. I said, "It's still on." And so we turned it off. It was a very 40s type of building. It was built in 1940. It was Seventh-day Adventist Hospital. Maybe it started in the late 30s. And they actually had physicians doing surgery here. There's old anesthesia stuff. And it was the hospital for the whole Lower Kenai Peninsula. And so was this harbor was, too, because it was a Greenwater Harbor in the wintertime. If it had ice, it was minimal. As opposed to what was going on Homer Spit, which could be really horrible ice. They had a boat harbor in behind the spit at the time, but it wasn't very usable. I take it back. When they built this harbor, they had a harbor. This harbor was for the whole Lower Kenai until they got the road built in 52, the road down to Homer. And so they, about that time, things switched over to Homer being the primary place for the Lower Kenai.
Did you see, well, I guess that was before your time. I was going to ask if you saw a lot of changes then, but that happened before you were here.
Yeah, that was before earthquake, too, so a lot of things changed in that decade or two. Yeah. We were in the clinic. Just started a medical practice there, Cheryl and I. Originally, we would hire someone maybe to do janitorial or something like that, and then we'd find out, oh, no, we can't make enough money to do that. We couldn't afford to pay him. We had somebody answer the phone so Cheryl could do the billing and stuff like that, which took a lot of time, and pretty soon decided, no, we can't afford to do that. It's just not enough people in this town. Interesting. The way it turned out to be, Cheryl and I, Cheryl having no salary, no pay, I always say, though, that she got to have all the money because I never spent anything. And we learned to live on very little money because didn't have to rent the building. The city paid for the maintenance and the heat. We would live in town. We rented a building after they started building the clinic and the new clinic in 1980. We rented places, but up until 1980, we had a place to live that was free too.
So you were in that chilly room for a few years.
Yeah, it wasn't that chilly. It was just a lot of heat, a lot of oil.
Yeah.
Back in the days when oil didn't cost so much. Yeah.
So can you talk about kind of the process that led to the multi-purpose building coming together the way it did?
Well, yeah. Cheryl had, how did it go? She decided that we needed a new clinic. I mean, we went through a couple of years where the basement flooded. I mean, when it flooded, it flooded. And the heater was down there. So as soon as it started flooding in March, because it would melt around the foundation, and so the water would come down the surface and run down near the building because it was so warm that it melted. And so all the water would go in the basement. You'd have to wear hip waders sometimes to go around there. And that put the furnace out. And that's usually when it started raining. So it leaked from the roof, too. It was a flat roof building. Willard's put a peak roof on it. We told him he better do that if he bought the building. So after a while, we got tired of that. It took us 6 years because about 78. Cheryl decided that we needed a new building, and so she went and got on the city council. And so it was her that really put the impetus into starting the movement of getting a city building and trying to get it grant-funded through the state. And eventually it came and it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. Hugh Smith was the contractor, if I remember right. And he hired all high school kids, and they'd fill me in day to day. Oh, yeah, we've tilted it out to the back door, so all the blood will roll out the back door, I was told. That was Dougie Giles who told me that. He was a high school kid then. Or maybe just out of high school. Jim Hopkins was doing work too, and maybe he's the one that told me about the blood going out the back door because he was building the foundation at the time.
I'm assuming that that never actually happened.
No, we put a ball on the floor and it doesn't roll towards the back door. It was just a story. But it's been a good building for the city. It's maybe requires a lot of heat again. It's not really well designed for being a up here building, not with standards we're using more in the 80s and 90s, with, you know, vapor barriers and R60 insulation instead of R19.
Mm-hmm.
But been a good building for the city. I mean, both hands. Cheryl also works in the library, so she gets to use that part too. So once we move into the new building, now we don't have a place to live, so we're living rented houses, which is okay. But about the same time, we got property out on Seldovia Point, so I started building a building out there for us to live in. And I essentially built, I mean, even starting from cutting the lumber with a sawmill, built the whole building by myself, except I had some help putting the roof rafters up and some help getting the sheetrock up the stairs. Other than that, it was all me by myself. Kind mm-hmm. of fun project.
Mm-hmm.
All reading books on how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Fun time. Don't think I'd want to do it again. So then, I don't know, medical practice. So I was a member at Homer Hospital. staff member, so I admitted patients over there. Had an old Stinson that I'd fly back and forth. For a while there, we were doing OB in the clinic here because they had really no OB over at the hospital. They had a surgery department, but they didn't really have OB, so wasn't much different. I actually had an OB nurse who was the cop's wife. Gary Gunkel's wife was an OB nurse, so we had an OB nurse for doing OB. And basically what she'd do is when moms came in labor, she'd go downstairs and make donuts. Every once in a while I'd come up and say, how you doing? Yeah, it was great. Donuts helped.
Mm-hmm. So would you still have patients that would come from home or over here then because for the OB?
No.
Okay,
no,
it was just
no.
The people.
They had a hospital
the
over
did.
There, and they had blood. That's one thing the OB doc at ANMC asked me is, what do you do if mom starts bleeding? And that is a problem. It can be all of a sudden and be devastating. And the only answer was you'd have to put pressure on the uterus and go to Homer as fast as you can, get blood. Use oxytocin, the same thing that you induce a labor with to clamp down the uterus, and yeah, that too. We kept that on hand. But as soon as they got OB department at Homer, I was really happy to have all the ladies go over there for OB for delivery. But still, I take them over in the airplane at 4 in the morning sometimes. Oh, it's kind of fun. I remember one couple that we went over and got to Homer, just a beautiful clear night, but got to Homer and you could only see the first two runway lights. So I figured, must be the lights are out or something. But I got down close and it was tule fog. So we had to land on the first 40 yards of the runway. And then coast into the fog. And by the time I got to the parking space, my prop had iced up so much we could hardly go anywhere because it lost all its pull. Interesting night. Wouldn't want to take off in it. Yes. So I'd do rounds with the Stinson. That really was a hard situation because it always took much more money to go back and forth than I made seeing a patient in the hospital. So it was something that I just did because it was part of the job. When I was 50 years old, that'd be 1994. In 1994, I got to quit OB because there got to be a lot of docs over in Homer and they could do the OB. And I just said, okay, 50th birthday, I'm going to quit OB. That was a part of my practice that really left no private time. Mm-hmm. It was usually one baby a month. But one baby a month made you on pins and needles for 4 weeks out of the month, either because they were late or because they were early or whatever. And there's a lot of care in that last month, keeping a mom safe. So I was happy to be able to. Then I could go skiing for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. That's kind of why I came to Seldovia. It was when I left Lower 48, I did an internship and residency in internal medicine at the war zone in Oakland, Highland Alameda County Hospital. And I kind of got to the point, it's a 3-year residency, I got to the point where at the end of the second year I had already decided that I really didn't want to go into internal medicine. I wanted to go to a small town. So at the end of the second year, Cheryl and I just packed up an old scout that we had and came up the road. didn't know where we were going until we talked to Roman, who is a physicist up in Fairbanks. He said, try Soldovia. He ended up living in Hoonah, so he was that kind of person. At any rate, it's... where was I with... got lost there.
I think you were talking about, you know, packing up the Scout.
And yeah, I know that, but where did that come from? I was trying to figure out. At any rate, that was a back look, I guess. but getting rid of OB is what I was talking about.
Oh, and you were talking about skiing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. Well, Roman was a skier, too, and that's what we did when we first came up here, is we did some glacier skiing. We'd go out for a week at a time. He taught me really well that, you know, it's not good to ski on glaciers. It's no fun skiing roped. Mm-hmm. Unless you're going uphill. Going downhill, it's not fun to ski roped. That's why we came here, because I had decided when I left Lower 48, California, that it was, we were looking for a place that had no roads and mountains. Homer didn't fit that bill. So Annabeau had no trouble talking me out of wanting to be in Homer. In fact, I told him. See across, he could see out of his office window. He said, look across the bay, that's where I'm going. He says, oh yeah, I've been wanting to get somebody to take Soldovia off my hands. Mm-hmm.
Well, did he come over here as a visiting doctor?
He had been here. He had actually had an exam bench in the old hospital. Mm-hmm. He says, you can have it.
So was that kind of the arrangement? I think it was Dr. McCarty?
Oh, McMurtry.
McMurtry.
She had been there and wasn't too much stuff laying around, mm-hmm, from that. But Annabeau had the place pretty well stocked up for, mm-hmm, things that he... was doing. There's a microscope there. There's some rudimentary lab stuff, an old centrifuge and things like that.
Okay. So he would come over every so often and see patients here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And really didn't like doing it. They'd just soon have the patients go over there. So he was happy to have me come over here.
Can you talk a little bit more about the Hospital Guild? The people that were involved in some of the activities.
It's a great group of, and it was women mostly. All, I guess I should say, and maybe about a core of six of them. And I probably would say names that weren't on it, and names that, and forget people who were on it. It's just hard for me to know. But what I know is, anytime Cheryl and I needed some equipment. Just ask them. They ran the Wheel of Fortune at the Halloween carnival up at school, and so they had that, and then the money coming in. Then they had the pull tabs at the bar too, for being a nonprofit, and they could do that. And now the fire department's, mm-hmm, taken that over because, mm-hmm, they came. And so it went on for years. I mean, we got a new microscope. The old one was, you know, one of these kinds you put on and had a mirror, you shined it to sun, and you had the light source that way. You know what? I've gone back to that microscope sometimes.
Oh, really?
get a new Icon microscope, thousands of dollars, and the rheostat for the light goes out. Take it back to them. Oh, I'm sorry, we can't fix that. You have to buy a new one. I just took that old light source. Actually, Mildred McMurtry had a little light you plugged into the wall that she'd shine at the mirror. And so I just put the Nikon up on 2x2s and stuck the light under it. It worked great. Saved thousands of dollars. Our medical industry, there's a lot to be said about people and the need for profit. Mm-hmm. I'm sad. Maybe that's why I came to Seldovia too. I had no way of making profit. Okay, so hospital guild, new scale, new isolate for the babies. I'm just trying to think of all the things that has their name on it now. A Life Pack 12. It was the old, actually it was a Life Pack 7. But that actually saved somebody's life once. Not many of our Life Packs save lives, but that one saved a life. I can tell you that story. Wonderful old lady, I'm not going to say names. She came, she was sitting at the bar and fell out of her chair. And another famous guy around here, I won't say names, picked her up. You know, it was the Night Spot bar, so it was a block away from the clinic up on the hill. And she was a real light lady, about 98 pounds. He picked her up, thought she was dead, carried her up to the hospital. This is like 5 in the afternoon, kind of early in the bar room scene. Plunked her down on the bed, and she was pulseless and not breathing. Before I did anything else, just pulled out the Life Pack. Pop! She woke up. Unfortunately, a month later over in Seward, she died again, this time for sure. She had a problem, and that was before the days of bypass surgery and all the fancy cardiovascular things that the cardiologists are doing nowadays. It's amazing how much medicine has changed since 1974. Mm-hmm. Can I name a few things?
Sure.
When I came here in 74, there were 5 antibiotics. There was no CAT scans, no MRIs. We had a portable X-ray machine here, which was kind of fun to use and learn how to use.
And that was, I think, wasn't that kind of how the Hospital Guild formed, was to buy that X-ray?
It was there when I got there, so I don't know. They had helped Mildred, but I think the X-ray machine had been there since the hospital days back in the 40s.
Okay.
It was old portable, and it looked damn dangerous. There was no shielding, no coning, no nothing. I mean, I had this lead shield with a window, lead window through it that I'd get behind. And one day, the GE guy who comes around to all the X-ray machines in the state, he comes and he shows me, okay, here you are. And he puts his little X-ray reader sensor right behind the shield. He says, okay, shoot the machine. And the needle goes, I'm sure he had the game turned way up. But he, we were right above Gunkel's bedroom. So if I was X-raying in the middle of the night, I'd have to go get Gunkel's out of their bedroom. Anyway, so another digression there. What else did the Hospital Guild buy in that building? God, lots of things. The carpet. Copy machines, fax machines, all that kind of stuff. Actually, no, those two things Cheryl and I bought. It was hospital equipment that they kind of wanted to stay to, and stuff that didn't need a lot of maintenance is what they liked to get. But thousands of dollars that they put into that building. And you can still see their name tags on all the things that has it. Like the scale that we use, the old balance scale, it's got their name tag on it.
So when did they disband?
When the tribe started doing the clinic thing, the tribe started asking them to give money to both places, and they didn't like the pressure, so they just said, we quit.
Okay.
And it's unfortunate, because I think they enjoyed doing what they did. But they were all getting pretty old at that time, and it's work to go do this thing, and somebody has to do the book work to keep the nonprofit going, and Elaine usually did that, and she was starting to be a little senile at that time. Mm-hmm. That eventually was a major problem for her. It's terrible that we have to get old, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about you? So you mentioned, you know, some of the medicines and equipment and stuff that were different early. What effect did just being a doctor in a remote area have in kind of the way you practice medicine?
Oh, and changes that came? Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you an example. In the 1970s, if I wanted to review medical literature, you know, I came from a place where there's a medical library. You just go to the library and you look up stuff, right? There were no computers then. So when I came up here, if I wanted to look something up, you know, the kind of thing that I can do in 10 minutes today, I would phone the university library in Anchorage, and they had a medical library there, and say, I want to research this subject. And they would ask me some questions and make it more specific. And then they'd run it through their computer, which was, and they'd send me this thing in the mail. They would send me one of these things that still had the tear-off, certainly, you know, the little drive hold sides, yeah, a computer readout thing. And so there'd be about 15, 20 articles that they'd send me on the subject, just the names. And they say, okay, which ones do you want? And I'd call them back just to make it a little quicker. And tell them I want this one, that one, and this one. Okay, that'll be $30, $10 each. and then they'd print them out and send them to me. Or they'd send for a reprint, which you send to the publisher of the magazine. And so there's a mail time. And then about 2 weeks after I asked for the subject, I'd have something to read if I really did my due diligence, and they did their due diligence and worked on it right away. Not very timely.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, push a key, look it up, all the latest information. So much different. So much different. I was researching hepatitis C last night, you know, mainly because for the specific aspect of needle stick injuries and, you know, and what do you do? Is there post-exposure prophylaxis, they call it PEP, for hepatitis C? This answer is still no. There's no treatment that works. There's nothing that we do. You just wait and see if you get it or not. And then if you get it, there's really good treatment now. So I was able to look that up, you know, and it was an afterthought. I was working on a patient like that yesterday, and so I come to the question last night. Within 15 seconds, I got all the answers in front of me that I need to have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a library, online library that updates their information on a regular basis, so it's all recent stuff. It's just so easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost sinful. It's so easy.
Mm-hmm.
No work to it added anymore.
So going back to some of your early days in Saldovia, who are some of the kind of the people in town that you remember, some of the leaders or characters or who kind of stands
out?
Well,
Jack English has certainly got to mm-hmm. be remembered. I mean, he's mm-hmm. a person that he was city manager, mayor, all the things he can be, I guess. He kind of a notorious reputation. There were some stories going around about how he didn't like some hippies in town and it ended up burning them out. I don't know if it's true or not, but the house was actually burnt down. You can go still see the old place if you want to. It was out there past the outside beach, about a quarter mile walk to get to it, that they had built a house out there. Anyway, some fun stories about Jack. Cheryl went over to visit him one rainy, stormy night. We had been working in the clinic, but the power went off. So we decided, oh, well, that's the end of that. And so she went over to the newsstand, which is next to the post office, that empty room usually now. It used to be the newsstand, and Susan and Jack ran that. Anyway, they were sitting around in the dark talking, and Jack says to Cheryl, "Well, let's have some fun with this power outage." So he calls up, and I don't know who he called, but he called somebody and said, "Yeah, it was Gladys. She was on her snow machine, and she ran over the power cord going up to the TV tower." He hangs up the phone. He says, "Let's give it five." In other words, how long is it going to take for the story to get back to him in a different form? And it did, too. 5 minutes later, somebody called and told us it was Helen. Anyway, funny story. Who else? Well, notorious people in town. Squeaky Anderson, I didn't ever have any contact with, but there was a couple guys in town. Sparky. And I can't remember the other guy. But anyway, they were kind of 20-somethings, and they were notorious, running drugs, this, that, and the other. But they helped us out in the clinic anytime we needed help in the clinic. They were kind of a dynamic duo. If we needed something carried or lifted or pushed, or they had a good heart in them anyway. All the old families in town, Helen Josephson, Alice Nutbeam, the old people. Her sister was here for a while, and I forget her name. And Katie Kashaveroff, just grand old people. Before they built Lakeside, I guess they don't call it Lakeside anymore, but anyway, what I call Lakeside up there, they had this row of white houses there, mm-hmm. that all the old people lived in, each one individual, mm-hmm. each with own heating unit and so forth. And that was quite a community right there.
Where was that?
Right where the lakeside is now. Mm-hmm. They tore that down, and the ladies had to move out for a while, so they had to get someplace to live while they were building Lakeside. Interesting.
Were those houses that were built by the Native Association? Or?
No, it was... lock on her name. She lived right across the street from Lakeside, even up until she died here lately. Her son still lives here, and I'm going to remember the name just by working it through my brain in a second. her son's related to the Camerons, and what is his name? Linstead. And what was her first name? But they owned those white houses.
Okay.
Her husband was here too then, and I block on his name too, but they owned that little lot there with all the houses on it and rented them to the old people, kind of took care of them. And they were getting old themselves. They were kind of in the same community. Mm-hmm. Carl Linstead was his name. And Daisy Linstead was her name.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he was one of the partners in the Linwood, right? That started that?
You know, I don't know that.
Okay.
But maybe you're right. Mm-hmm. There was three of them, I guess, huh? Linwood or Nightspot?
The Linwood. The story I heard was that's where the Lynn part of Linwood
came from. Linstead?
Okay. From Linstead,
okay. Well, there must have been someone with wood then, too.
Mm-hmm. the yeah, there was, and I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, okay.
We'll have to ask Carl Jr. one of these days.
Yeah, and the Nightspot, our other notorious bar, had the same number of people. It was kind of backing it, too. I've always enjoyed Seldovia because I've always felt it's a 50-50 town. At least it wasn't one-sided. But pick any subject you want, 50-50. and adamant. It's not in some of the middle. It's this or this. I mean, bar people, church people, police people, Republicans, Democrats, whatever. Mm-hmm. 50-50, right down the middle. I don't know if the I'll have to ask Cheryl, because she helps with the voting now, if it's really turning out to be that way. But I know in the last election that the further south you got on the peninsula, the more Democratic it got. It was interesting. Well, I guess that goes to say that the oil people are north and the fishermen are south.
And you raised a couple of kids here, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't have kids when you came? You had...
No.
Okay.
In fact, that's why Cheryl went on the city council, is you had to get it done before we'd have kids.
To get the multi-purpose building?
Yeah, right. Once she had kids, she wasn't going to do any politicking anymore.
Okay.
Anyway, it's... so Sean was born in 80. And Jennifer, we actually adopted, but is a relative of ours, so she comes up as family. And so we got her when she was 3. Mm-hmm. And both of them are doing well.
Mm-hmm. What was it like raising kids here, you think, compared to other more traditional communities, I guess, you know, think larger on the road system?
Well, kind of fun, because that was getting to be the era where there was drug problems and drive-by shootings and things like that. And, you know, if you lived in downtown Detroit, you wouldn't let your kids run free. Maybe in San Francisco you might. They get run over, but not drive-by shot. But we lived, I did part of my training in Berkeley. I lived in Berkeley, worked in Oakland, and you wouldn't let your kids run around in downtown Berkeley or Oakland. Is too violent. I worked in the war zone. A lot of the things I took care of were gun stabbings, gunshot wounds, drunken driving, and bad wrecks, things like that. Just the war zone, I call it. Shootouts in the emergency room. So, big difference.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty laid-back place. And the other thing that was really different about Seldovia, and maybe different even than the West Coast, the small villages of Alaska, is we had no trauma here. I mean, the whole time I was here, we saw 2 stab wounds, two deaths from stab wounds, and 1 car wreck with a death. Other than that, it's good old internal medicine stuff, which is what I wanted to do. So actually didn't even have to take care of the car wreck because he drowned. Stab wounds I got to take care of, but they died anyway. medicine, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, high blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
all the stuff that I did in my training. I picked the right place. Homer is much more traumaful. The west coast of Alaska, the small villages, I think because of alcohol, is much more traumaful too. But here we seem to be a more mellow people.
Mm-hmm.
We just talk too much. that's probably been one of my endeavors since I've been in Seldovia, trying to get people to talk to each other. It's really sad that we have to be a 50-50 town with nothing in between.
Mm-hmm.
Need a new subject. Burnt them all out.
Do you take any different approach to medicine being in a remote area than you might in a more urban area?
Well, if I was in Anchorage, for instance, it would be a lot easier to use consultants.
Mm-hmm.
There's 2 reasons why you don't get to use consultants here. One, they're not here, and people don't want to travel. So we're moving to an era now of video medicine, which until now, they got to be really fancy about it. Dedicated line, you know, it's all this HIPAA stuff where you got to be, the information can't get out there free anyway, and nobody can steal medical information, although, anyway, there's the HIPAA laws and made it tough. So we can't have things that are exposed to hacking somewhere in the train of things. So we got to have these fancy video upsets with the dedicated G3 line so you can send lots of data quickly to make them work. And so that's kind of hard to do, but it's possible. But on the other hand, there's things like Facebook and Skype that would make it so easy to do. And maybe you don't even need that. Telephone works pretty good for doing consultant work. And let's say you, 'cause we still use fax, but for some reason, internet, email, that kind of stuff is not considered HIPAA-proof unless it's fancily encrypted. Fax machine is still considered HIPAA-proof or HIPAA-compliant, but I can see where it wouldn't be. It's so easy to dial a wrong number and it goes somewhere else, but at least that's not somebody trying to hack into the system to get medical information. So it's not quite like getting your social security number and your mother's maiden name.
And I have too many more questions for you, I guess, but you mentioned skiing a lot and spending a lot of time exploring in the backcountry. Can you just talk about some of your experiences there? And
when I first came here, skiing was really tough because of the alders. The underbrush is just horrible for skiing around here, at least if you're going to start from the road. So Red Mountain Valley was the one place we could go where you could drive or ski-doo or snow machine to a place where the mountains were not blocked by alders. So at any rate, in 74, I came here in the winter and tried to go skiing, and it was impossible. Even in March, when it's a lot of snow, it was impossible to get down through the alder belt. So in the summer of 75, I went up with a handsaw and started cutting a ski trail to make it so we'd have access to the ridge tops. And I think I got about 14 feet that first day. I decided I needed a chainsaw.
Was this in the Red Mountain area?
Or? No, this was out front side here.
Okay.
Actually, it was access up to the ridge above Kississna Bay. In other words, the north side of Barabra Creek. And that's a whole lot of skiing up there, so it was worth to make a trail. Person came to town who was also a skier, a good skier like I was, and he started helping me. That's Dave Chartier, and so we made a lot of ski trails, or made that ski trail and started skiing with that, and then we decided that wasn't enough, so we had to take a trip, and so one of our first trips was up to Seldovia Lake, but the way we went through Red Mountain Valley over the top and down into the lake, and took a couple of years to figure out which was the best way to go and where was the best place to camp, so you'd be right at the skiing. For a while we camped up in one of the passes, and it was just a wind hole. Couple of years where there wasn't much snow and we couldn't ski at the lake because there's a lot of alders there too. We'd camp in what everybody here calls Red Mountain Valley, but the valley is named after the river, and it's more aptly named Windy Valley because it's a windy place too. Wind in that valley sounds like a freight train when it's coming up the valley. You can hear it coming for miles. And it's because it's kind of set north-south in the terrain. It that when the southeast wind's coming through, it has to go around a 90-degree corner, which takes it into a Venturi effect. So it'll be like 100-knot gusts that hit you, and all of it, like a ton of bricks up there in the wintertime. And so one of the funny stories about our camping is that we started out with a nylon rain fly for a tent. That's what we slept under. It was light to carry and, you know, kept the snow out. It was a good place to sleep. You just pile up snow on the outside edges, and it was for Mount McKinley, four-man tent. And so we'd sleep under that, and we put a tarp up in the trees and build a fire under it. Well, that, in all those windy places, that was horrible because, you'd be cold and wet on one side and smoke-filled face on the other side. Maybe you were warm on one side. Really, if you got wet that day, you couldn't dry out around that fire, even if you had a lot of firewood, which there wasn't a lot of. So we started carrying more and more nylon, and it kind of came up with things like, you know, leaning against a tree and having the fire into the tree, but the spindrift would come in around the edges. So we finally decided, okay, we got to close this thing in. We got to make it. So we ended up sewing our own teepee, a 14-foot nylon teepee. We thought, oh, my God, we're going to burn this down the first time we use it. But we've had it now 35, 40 years. We've had three or four teepees. They don't get any sparkles in them. They just eventually rip up in the wind is what happens to them. But totally safe to have a fire in a nylon teepee. It's kind of interesting to find out. But that made it so you could go out in one of these storms that we have around here, these sleet storms that blow 60 knots and go skiing and mush and come back soaking wet, and you could dry out. That made it so we could go 3 or 4 weeks at a time just living in a teepee. We would take 5-gallon oil buckets, fill them full of food, and drop them out of an airplane and ski up to them, and we'd be eating moose or bear meat or just wonderful things to eat, fresh vegetables, things that campers never get. I mean, the old dehydrated camp meals, no way, we didn't do those anymore. Pack everything in with dog food around it to make it tight, and then the dogs got to come too. So yeah, made it really a fun thing to do.
What's the structure of the teepee? What makes it?
Oh, single pole in the center. And then tie it out with lines. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of poles to cut down. Mm-hmm. Usually we find a pole laying down and we just stand it up, tie it up, put the teepee up. Well, you have to dig down to the dirt, so that takes some time because you can't build a fire on a bank of snow because it'll eat its way down into the snow and pretty soon you're looking down a hole at your fire. Mm-hmm. But the worst, you know, you always build a put the teepee up under the trees because you don't want it in a lot of wind. And so you go up to the upper trees, find a spot that's flat, preferably wind blocked by trees for the winds that are heavy, and dig a hole 14 feet wide. It doesn't have to go down to the ground, but the 6-foot fire circle, 6-foot diameter circle has to go down to the ground. And you sit on the snowbank where your sleeping bags are, put your feet on the ground, and have a little bench to sit on. Mm-hmm. And it's very comfortable.
And do you have a hole for the smoke to escape?
Or? Well, a regular Sioux teepee with the smoke mm-hmm. flaps. And, okay. You know, wind blows one way, you get it flapped one way. Again, wind blows the other way, you flap it the other way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you thought about patenting that?
Well, Sue already have it. I wouldn't want to try to patent it.
No, I meant the single pole version, though, that would be different.
I don't know if that makes it. The material, the design is, I mean, we bought the Sue teepee book. The Indian teepee, I think the book's called. So it really gets into all the teepees. Sue used a tripod to set their teepees up, and the Crow used a quadrupod to set their poles up. So there's different ways and different cuts. But basically, you just, if you lay it out on the ground, it's a half circle. And you got a bolt of nylon, bolt of nylon, bolt of nylon. It's really simple to sew. And then this little leading this edge on the inside that ends up being the smoke flap in the door, little sewing, but not much. Even I could sew that, so we made our own. Yeah, it's not too well-known fact about how easy it is, how good an area this is for camping, how good an area this is for skiing. Mm-hmm. Keep it secret.
We won't tell them exactly where you go. Have you seen much change in that over the years, the number of people that you encounter in the backcountry?
None. The only people we encounter in the backcountry are people that come with us. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're too hard on people or what, but it's really hard to get people to want to go with you. Well, we go for so long, and none of the kids that are working can do that. Usually, you know, their bosses tell them, no, you can't leave. And so we've had people come up, like we're going to be there 2 weeks. They'll come up for 1 week, which is nice for them because they got a place to live, and we drop the food in for them. And so all I got to do is bring their gear and and really don't have to have a tent, just a sleeping bag.
Are you still flying?
Well, I wish I was, but I lost my airplane. It in the saltwater environment we live in, it corroded out from under me. Mm-hmm. They finally wouldn't let me fly it anymore.
Mm-hmm. What airplane was it?
It was a 46 Stinson.
Okay. And did you learn to fly up here?
Yeah, with that airplane.
From someone local, or how did you?
Yeah, a guy named Greniger over in Homer was an instructor, and I learned with him. And he was an old guy, so old airplane, old guy went together pretty well. Mm-hmm. He was also a mechanic, so he took care of the airplane, too. Mm-hmm. Not many mechanics these days can take care of those old airplanes. It was a fun thing to be able to fly, my eye in the sky. That's how we knew where to put the ski trails. That's how we knew how to get to the lake. Nowadays, we don't go from Red Mountain Valley anymore. We go straight up the valley. It's the quickest and the flattest. You don't have the ups and downs. Mm-hmm. Boy, that country is tough. It's tough country. There's no way there's going to be a four-wheeler into that lake ever unless they build some horrendous bridges. Mm-hmm. There's one canyon up there that once you get within 40 yards of the river, it's 300 feet deep.
Really?
Yes. Oh, and it's V-shaped. Right down at the river, you can cross that creek, but it's tough country. Now, there have been snow machines into the lake. We actually saw a snow machine that came from the Port Graham, a track that came from the Port Graham side, but he just went to the top of the pass and he went back to Port Graham. He didn't want to venture down in the valley for fear of maybe not being able to get back up. But we've had a couple kids from town make it to the lake, but they ran out of gas and had to go back from the lake. They couldn't spend any time up there. So it's a pretty pristine place. Pretty nice place for skiing. There's five passes that come in from Sylvia Lake, come into Sylvia Lake. Two of them come from Red Mountain Valley Way. Actually, I think one, two, three of them that come in. One of them from Rocky River, or two of them from Rocky River, one right next to Red Mountain, and one comes right from the pass at the end of Red Mountain Valley. And then there's a couple passes that go to Port Graham, and then a whole head range that's just spectacular. Spectacular. It's any skiing, any person who is the most athletic, highest degree skier can find things they want to do up there. It's an amazing place. David's going to be mad that I told everybody.
Well, maybe put some special restrictions on this part.
Well, I'm just hoping that it's not going to be viewed by a lot of skiers. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of skiers around here, although we're getting more and more, let me think. There's probably 15, 20 really good skiers in this area now. And I don't know if they came here like me because this is a place you could have some really good skiing. I mean, I knew that from the outset, before I got here, that this is the kind of place I wanted to live in. I thought about Southeast, but it just snows too much down there. There are rains too, and it's just too much that it's not safe for avalanches, and it's not safe, and you don't get enough days. We have found that on our cut trails, that you'd think you'd want to get to the top and ski on the top part, but the months of December, January, February, it's what I call the W's. Wind, white out, and wet. Those months, it's so bad on top, we ski on the trails because it's down in the trees and the trees kind of pull the snow in. It's deeper, it's not wind blown. That's the other W, wind blown. Mm-hmm. Well, wind blown. Wind blown snow is a soft underneath crust on top, really hard to ski in. Because you break through it. Mm-hmm. And it's that way. Well, we aren't skiing yet this year, but and last year we didn't ski till February, so maybe global warming's going to take me further north. I don't know. we've had years like this before. We're hoping we get a good year yet this year. Mm-hmm. Still early.
Yeah. Have you noticed much change in the weather over the years? How much snow and
I am not a person who's living through geologic timing. So to me it seems like we have good years and bad years, and some of the good years are amazingly good. I mean, you can take an alder forest that's 20 feet high with alders that are 4 feet or 4 inches, you know, big stems, and in first of March you're skiing over the top of them. They're all down flat. Well, you know, they're covered up with 6 feet of snow, but that's not 20 feet of snow. It's 6 feet of snow, and they're down flat. And there's other years they're all standing proud. I've always said that if they're not down in December, because December, as we're getting right now, it's windless. And so the alders hold the snow, and the next snow that comes on top puts them down. And if that happens in December, they're down. But if they're up in January, they're probably going to stay up. It's not always true. They go down a little bit as the snow load comes on through February and March. And there are certainly times you can ski anywhere you want in this country, alders or not. But most of the time, we're really happy to have our ski trails. Mm-hmm. Homer's kind of happy to have our ski trails, too. We got to start charging them a fee.
So I guess maybe kind of wrapping things up, if you kind of look back over your years in Soldovets, because you came here, you said, 74, so mm-hmm. about 40 years now. What would you say are some of your strongest impressions of the town? Like, what words kind of come to mind when you think about Soldovia?
Good place to raise kids. Until you get to junior year in high school, then they better go. If they want to go to college, they better go somewhere else. They just can't have enough teachers to teach the pre-college courses. That's unfortunate. Pretty mellow place as far as, like I told you, with trauma. It's, you know, that's really says a lot for a community. I wish that we wouldn't be so 50-50, that we would maybe talk a little more between the groups. And I don't know, maybe that's a sign of the times. Our Congress is certainly having the same problem. Yes. Maybe something will happen and force us together again.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come in.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.